I think we have at least most of the people who are actually going to be coming, even if not everybody. So, to summarize where I was sometime earlier today, a few hours ago, I was talking about the projects for this course and saying in a nutshell that the course projects are to set new speed records. Which you might initially think is something inconceivable, that after many decades of cryptography, surely people have the fastest software for all sorts of interesting cryptographic operations, but I hope I succeeded in convincing you in the last 5 minutes this morning that cryptographic software, even very popular cryptographic software for extremely widely used cryptographic operations, is considerably slower than it could be. Do not assume that your existing software is fast, existing cryptographic software, or any other type of software. There are certainly other pieces of software where people care about the speed, and sometimes it's very carefully optimized, but most of the time it is not. The example that I gave this morning was OpenSSL, which is by far the most popular browser encryption software, browser signature software. This is the software that's used by browsers in order to check signatures, create signatures, etc. And if you use this software for a very standard cryptographic operation, modular exponentiation at, let's say, 1024 bits, 1024-bit mod exponentiation, computing a power mod n, then it is much, much slower than GMP. Depending on your machine, say a factor of 2 slower. On a Pentium 4, very common processor, it's a factor of 2 slower than GMP. It is solidly beaten by GMP. Next question you might ask about the course project beyond, well, is it actually possible to set new speed records? Is it reasonable to expect to set new speed records? Is, all right, what functions should you take? Should you take an existing function or make up something new? And that's an important question. Should I build a new function, make a new function, or should I take a cryptographic function that somebody has already specified, use someone else's function, now the fact that you can ask this question reasonably is something that distinguishes cryptographic algorithm design from general algorithm design. Normally, algorithm designers will not change the functions because typically in algorithm design, you're given a function. And then you might be given some software for that, an algorithm, and you look at the speed of that algorithm, you analyze the speed of your computations, and whatever algorithms you're looking at, the rules of the game say you're allowed to change how you're doing your computations to improve the speed, or to not improve the speed, but you want the best speed, so you can change the computation. Of that function to improve speed. But in cryptography, you have an extra option, not just changing the computation. For a cryptographer, you have the extra flexibility, the extra power to change the function. Extra power for a cryptographer is to change the function that you're computing. And not just how it's computed. This considerably expands the space of computations you have to think about. It's not just computations of one function, it's computations of many different functions. In fact, this might sound kind of silly. Why don't you just choose a function that's trivial to compute? The identity function. Well, we're only allowing certain functions. They have to do whatever operations we're interested in, and they have to be secure, or at least conjecturally secure. We allow any function that at least conjecturally, and sometimes we insist on various forms of proof, let me put conjecturally with a question mark, any function that conjecturally is secure, resists attack. Nobody is able to break it. Now, if you define a new function for something, then there are some problems, and I'm going to recommend against engaging in this game for a course project. It's certainly something you can do, but if you do it, if you design a new function for, say, Diffie-Hellman, if you choose some group upon which you would like to do Diffie-Hellman, or if you design your own stream cipher or do any other sort of cryptographic new function, then you immediately are faced with questions about the security of that function. If someone else designs a function, then that someone else can answer the questions about security. The questions don't go away, but they're not your problem. If you build a new function, then it's your problem. Building a new function, hello screensaver, building a new function means that you have to analyze the security. And it also makes your task of setting records considerably more difficult, because you have to not just compete with the implementations of one function, but you have to compete with all the software for every function that does the same operation. For example, Diffie-Hellman. If you're building a new Diffie-Hellman function, you are competing with all Diffie-Hellman functions. Otherwise, the interest in your records for that particular function are dramatically reduced, because people will say, why are you building a new Diffie-Hellman function which is not as fast as our existing Diffie-Hellman functions? You have to look at every Diffie-Hellman function out there if you want to set a record with a new Diffie-Hellman function. Whereas, if you just take one function, there's not nearly as much competition. Now, this is certainly, at the research level, this is one of the important games that people play, and let me say that analyzing, building new functions, analyzing their security, looking at all the different functions available is certainly something that helps the users, helps Google, helps whoever might be using cryptography. It's also something enjoyable from a research perspective, but for this course, for the project, I don't recommend that you do it, because it has exactly these difficulties. So for the course, I recommend starting. I'm going to, in my lectures, talk about functions which were designed in this way and then had the security analysis and are trying to compete with everything and competing successfully with everything out there. But for the course project, you should pick some old function. You should at least starting with old functions. Pick some old function, F, and then compete with the software for that function, F. Competing with the software for that function, which is a much more restricted set of software. You could even choose something non-cryptographic if you like. And a lot of the techniques that I talk about will be independent of the application area. Certainly many of the techniques that I've already mentioned and many of the techniques I'll go through in a lot of detail are things that are useful only for cryptography, but many of the techniques are things useful more generally. And as usual, I'm not interested in the academic distinctions between different levels of generality of the techniques. I'm just interested in the highest speed for cryptography. However, if you're choosing a course project and thinking, hey, maybe I should try to speed up fast Fourier transforms or my favorite video game, whatever function you're interested in computing, you might find that the techniques in this course are useful for speeding up that computation as well. Anyway, assuming that you are interested in cryptographic computations, the next natural question, and I think the last question on my list of what you should be asking about course projects, although maybe I will be surprised and faced with some more questions, is, okay, how do you choose these functions? How do I find, for the project, a function to speed up? And here, I've been talking about what you can give to Google, but here Google gives something back to you. There are many, many, many interesting cryptographic functions, and I have in Firefox here some of these functions. Let me give some of the answers that you might be interested in for this question, depending on your taste. There are, first of all, some of the simpler functions out there are stream ciphers submitted to the eStream project. Here's the homepage for eStream. The homepage for eStream, the eCrypt stream cipher project. Yeah, many stream ciphers, new stream ciphers, all of them are within the last few years, submitted to eStream. This is, as the webpage here suggests, a project which started a couple years ago by eCrypt, the European Network of Excellence in Cryptology, which has the indecipherable logo shown up at the top left here. And they also have on their webpages this cute little gray square on the right side. The eCrypt webpages, yeah, they'll tell you all about eCrypt. It's actually a lot of useful information, and one of the things that they've been doing the last couple years is trying to identify interesting new stream ciphers. And they've also taken some stream ciphers from the last year or two before that, which people submitted, but they're mostly stream ciphers designed in, I guess, in 2005, and then some updates. There have been some attacks on these ciphers. Here's the list of phase two candidates after a selection phase. You can see here a list of lots of different ciphers, and actually it keeps going for a while, and actually there's an even bigger list of all the original submissions, end of phase one. Here's all the initial submissions. The list that you see, Dragon, HC, Lex, Felix, etc., those are names of specific ciphers, specific functions that people need to compute, and here's some more examples of ciphers, and these were for software purposes classified in the way that you would expect. A bunch of experienced cryptographers, experienced stream cipher designers got together in a room and pointed to their own stream cipher proposals as being the ones worthy of future study. They had various criteria for deciding what was most interesting, and largely the most interesting ciphers are the ones that had not been broken and were the fastest. But okay, there's various ciphers that are still under study, the phase two, then there were some that for reasons of speed or security were archived. That means, okay, sorry, we're not going to look at them anymore, but there's still potentially ciphers that people are interested in. Maybe more interest is towards the left. There are all these phase two software ciphers, all these focus phase two software ciphers. And then on the hardware side, there's quite a lot of ciphers, although the ones that are still on the hardware list here tend to be ones where we don't know the hardware performance and it's probably not too good, depending on the cipher. Then there's some that are particularly fast in hardware, which might motivate also asking exactly how fast they are in software. There's one interesting candidate, Felix, which is on the list both for Focus Phase 2 hardware and Focus Phase 2 software. Felix is a cipher that was designed for good speed in both of those settings, also includes a message authentication code built in, although that's not something that I would recommend actually using for reasons that I'll get into. Anyway, there's lots and lots of ciphers here, and certainly many of these have only crude implementations, which you might try to speed up. All right, there's more possible answers beyond the eStream ciphers, and if you're interested in anything about cipher design, block ciphers, or stream ciphers, you should certainly look at all these latest stream ciphers, as I know some of you already have. Let's see, another answer. What is second on my list? It's the problem with lists. Oh, yes, hash functions. There are all sorts of hash functions out there, also on the sort of secret key side of the world, without the mathematical constraints of a public key encryption function or public key signature, etc. These hash functions, the best list that I know of is by Paolo Barreto, who has a hashing lounge, a place where all the hash functions get together and hang out on the web. And here it is, the hashing function lounge. So you should be able to find that with Google. The goal of this site is to give an overview of cryptographic hash functions. Okay, it goes on for a while and has some general comments, and then here's a list of a whole bunch of hash functions, including some rather unhappy notes on the right side. That little skull there means you don't want to use that hash function. Question marks are, okay, we don't know how secure the hash function is. And then there's, I'm not quite sure about this red cross symbol there, but, well, anyway. There's a lot of these where They seem to be secure. At least we don't know that they've been broken. Maybe more towards the end of the list, suggesting something about the quality of the ciphers. Sorry, the quality of the hash functions designed by people who choose names that start with letters early in the alphabet. But well, anyway, there's some good ones with small names as well, like FSD. Does not seem to have been broken, and that's one where, boy, I've looked at some of these functions, and there's all sorts of interesting structure, like the FSB function, where you could speed up lots of levels of the function, and, okay, here's lots of functions. Some of the functions that have attracted the most interest, like MD4, MD5, is dead. It's very seriously dead. People are recommending strongly against using it, and that promotes interest in lots of these other functions. SHA-1, here's that Red Cross symbol. Everybody's quite scared of the current status of SHA-1. It's not something where people have found a collision, but okay, there's lots and lots of hash functions which have some implementations, but certainly lots of legitimate targets for better cryptographic software. And then, of course, there are many public key systems. Which, not just recently, but traditionally through the history of cryptography, have attracted a lot of interest. And I want to point out one way that some formerly obscure classes of public key systems have attracted extra interest. If you look at what happens with quantum computers, then you see that quantum computers, assuming that they're built, and the current consensus is that, well, if you give many billions of dollars to the people doing research on the topic, then they will build a quantum computer for you. Assuming that they are built, quantum computers will destroy all of our favorite current public key crypto systems. They will kill RSA, DSA, ECDSA, etc. Which naturally means that all the other public key systems out there get a boost. There's been increasing interest for this reason. The threat of quantum computers has promoted various other public key systems, adding interest to post-quantum systems. And here I have a list of four different types of systems that you might be interested in, each of which has several different candidates. There is the simplest type, hash-based systems. For example, there's a system by Merkle, which started this off. There's the CMSS improvement of Merkle's system, and various modifications, the bins and balls system, lots of different variants of hash-based post-quantum public key signatures. There are the multivariate quadratic systems, which have some performance advantages over the Merkle-type systems, the hash-based systems. Some of them are a little bit scary. HFE in its simplest forms has been broken. On the other hand, variants of it, like what's called HFE minus, seem to be, I should put all these in quotes, these are Google terms which I haven't defined, but HFE minus seems perfectly secure and is faster than the hash systems. There are, on the encryption side, a couple of classes of good candidates. There are code-based systems, which have been around for 30 years with no serious attacks. Aside from, well, even if you have an exponential time computation, put together a big enough computer and put enough work into the algorithms, and maybe you can make it exponential time with a small enough constant to fit within your computers for particular parameter sizes. But the basic idea of the systems is fine. System by McLeese, dating from the late 70s, has held up just fine. And then there are some systems newer, but with performance advantages, maybe a little less trustworthy. The conjectures are maybe things that don't inspire as much confidence, but the lattice-based systems, leading candidate being Entrue, also seem to survive quantum computers. All these classes of crypto systems, again, within each of these categories, there are several reasonable candidates, and we just don't have enough software. We need software for these systems. If quantum computers are built and RSA goes away, DSA goes away, there's very little software for these systems. Some of these do have some software, but I don't think the software has been very well optimized. All right. Did I have some other comment about post-quantum Yes. So the comment was, of course, to look at this webpage. Yeah, PQ Crypto 2006, the International Workshop on Post-Quantum Cryptography, had a distinguished list of speakers, and there were the invited speakers and a bunch of contributed talks, and you can see in the middle here, PQ Crypto 2006 record. That is a not gigantic PDF file that includes most of the contributed talks. The invited speakers generally didn't have write-ups, but this has a whole bunch of papers about post-quantum cryptography, and if you look down the list, then you can see abstracts for the talks and who was contributing to this, and somewhere in there you can get some idea of the systems that people are talking about. Okay, hotels you can probably skip for this conference back in May 2006, but okay, here's some topics. Can quantum computers be built? Post-quantum hash-based cryptography, an abstract there. Statistical zero knowledge, that's for theoretical study of the security of these things. Post-quantum multivariate quadratics, multivariates, more multivariate quadratic stuff. And you can see a lot of different attacks, a lot of different systems. If you look at the papers, follow some reference lists, then, again, there's this workshop record that is online, and you can get a lot of references, find various systems which we need implementations of. So that's a lot of good targets for doing fast cryptographic software. If you have no idea what you're interested in cryptography, but you feel some motivation to learn how to do high-speed cryptography, then I recommend picking some random system from this list. All right, I have certain exclusions from the list of functions that I've written down here. This is not an absolute exclusion, but I think you should start with functions that don't have assembly language software out there already. I recommend starting with functions that don't have ASM, assembly language, implementations. For example, if you look at AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, lots of people use it. Extremely popular block cipher, or as used, extremely popular stream cipher. It's fairly difficult to improve the software for AES. It's not something inconceivable, and in fact, everybody I know of who has actually tried to improve AES software has succeeded in doing so, but it takes a lot of work. The improvements are relatively small. It is certainly more difficult to speed up, for example, software for AES, or one of the functions that I'm going to talk about as a state-of-the-art cryptographic software function is going to be something which has very fast software, and, well, you can look at these functions, for instance, Curve25519, and see, all right, there's assembly language software sitting there with some strong performance claims, which means it's probably not the best idea to try to speed it up. Not impossible, certainly there are improvements possible, but it's pretty close to the best possible, so at least best possible implementation of that function. As I'll be going through, there are bottlenecks for these functions, and the current software is pretty close to those bottlenecks. So don't try to speed up these pieces of software that have assembly language implementations compared to there's all sorts of functions, all sorts of cryptographic function implementations that are not in assembly language and that you reasonably can expect to speed up. I should write down explicitly here, this is just because it's harder doesn't mean it's impossible. And when you get into the serious research game, then you should start contemplating speeding up the existing functions as well as changing functions to improve the speed and then worrying about security and so on. But for the course project, statistically, if you pick some random function that already has an assembly language implementation, you'll have to do more work to speed it up than if you pick some random function that doesn't have an assembly language implementation. So I think that's a reasonably safe recommendation. For those of you who decide to do public key systems, there's this benchmarking project where I was showing you some graphs before. Is there a question? Okay. Let's see, there's multivariate quadratics, and then there's code-based. This is MacLeese, M-C-E-L-I-E-C-E. But yeah, the thing to look up, is, let me write it here, is this PQ Crypto 2006. I've had some vague thoughts of putting a bibliography online for these post-quantum systems, but at least if you follow the workshop record there, I think it has references to essentially every system out there, and in particular the MacLeese system is a very popular code-based public key system, popular in the research literature. If you look for post-quantum systems, then MacLeese stands out as one of the first candidates. Merkel also stands out as one of the first candidates for a system that is held up extremely well. Nobody has any idea how to attack these systems in better than the exponential time that you would expect for any system. All right. Had one more pane here on this eBat. So yeah, if you do public key, then I recommend submitting your software to this eBat project. For example, you pick one of these post-quantum systems. If you implement public key signatures, or public key encryption, which has not so far appeared in my list and won't be a major focus of this course. As far as I know, the concept of public key encryption is never one that provides the best speed, but nevertheless, it has attracted a lot of interest. There are many public key encryption functions in the literature, and there's nothing wrong with speeding up the different encryption functions that people have mentioned, have people have talked about, like RSA encryption, or if you do public key exchange, public key secret sharing, Diffie-Hellman, in whatever group. For example, before I was mentioning modular exponentiation for 1024 bits, exponentiation mod a 1024 bit prime, say. That's exactly the computation you need to do for the traditional Diffie-Hellman system, not the elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, which I'll be talking about. You can reasonably go back to non-elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman and see how fast you can make that, whether you can do better than, say, OpenSSL. As I've said, GMP is faster than OpenSSL, and it's even possible to do better than GMP. So you should not assume that any existing software, even for very popular computations, should not assume that existing software is very fast. If you do any of these types of systems, signatures, encryption, secret sharing for public key type systems, then you should submit your software to this eBats project. eBats, which stands for eCrypt Benchmarking of Asymmetric Systems. That's what's shown up there. The question, let's look at the web page for a minute here. The question here is, how fast are the different public key crypto systems out there? How do the speeds vary from one machine to another? Well, you could just pick a machine and then look at the different systems, or you could pick a system, look at different machines. How much bandwidth do the systems use? That's a sort of second-order speed issue, which I'll talk more about later. And then there's some APIs here, very simple for implementing this software. There's also, you can download the benchmarking tools if you want to check that your software works with these benchmarking tools, assuming that the network works. Well, eventually there will be the Batman, that's the benchmarking of asymmetric tools on multiple architectures non-interactively, Batman. There's also a visualization environment, computer-aided visualization environment, CAVE, or comparison and visualization environment. I don't remember what any of this stands for. Anyway, Batman and CAVE are some software you can download. And then if you download the benchmarking tools, you can also download the existing BATs. Those are benchmarkable asymmetric tools. And then unpack those and look at examples of some public key systems that fit into the API. And then, you can also run benchmarks and submit your own timings, but there's lots of computers which things are already timed on. I should say here, if you submit your software to eBats, then that makes the software and its timings publicly available. So the software is going to be one of these benchmarkable asymmetric tools, something that fits the very simple API. And then the software will be timed for you on a bunch of different computers. Software will be magically timed, and the timings will be made publicly available with the database of benchmarks that are available here. And so Yeah, I should also say there's some timeline here that eCrypt, which is running this project, wants to have a report by the end of the year, end of this year, and another report middle of next year on benchmark results. The timings for the software will be reported. If they're good, then it'll be at the top of the list of, hey, here's how fast the software is for some system. For instance, S-Flash, one of the submissions, which is one of these multivariate quadratic type systems for signatures, S-Flash has remarkably good performance. It has one little performance problem, but it's for signing and verification, it's certainly competitive with RSA. The security is something which is hard to assess currently. We're quite confident about the performance of all the attacks that people have thought about against RSA. It's not so clear what the best attacks are against S-Flash, but nevertheless, it has not been broken. It seems like a reasonably secure system, and that's one example of software you can see in eBEF. Okay, so this is another optional add-on to the course project. Again, if you don't have any idea what to look at, then I'd recommend taking one of these post-quantum systems, thinking beyond the age of RSA and elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman and so on, to a day when those are all killed by quantum computers. And then we'll need these post-quantum systems. If you're ambitious, you could imagine writing software that's really fast and that people could even use now. Entru tries to tell people, hey, it's not just a post-quantum system, it's a system that provides pretty good performance compared to RSA, and you might want to use it right now. But anyway, without worrying about the users for the course project, the idea is pick some function and make that function run faster using the techniques that I'm going to talk about or other ideas that you have. I think that's all I had about the course project. Let me pause at this point and find out, are there any questions about what's going on with the course projects from people who are definitely or maybe going to actually do the project? Yeah.
What machines are admissible?
What machines are admissible? Well, to the extent that I focus on particular machines, I will be choosing some popular machines. Specifically, I'm going to start with a teaching tool called the UltraSpark, which used to be sold as a Sirius processor, but, well, it is a very convenient processor to start understanding how machines actually work, what the latency and parallelism issues are on real computers. Then I'm going to talk about some Sirius computers, the Pentium 3, the Athlon. I'm contemplating doing the Athlon 64, not sure yet if I want to get that complicated. But certainly big platforms like that are, of course, there are many users who care about performance on those. There are some more obscure computers like the Alpha, where it's a dead architecture, but there are still some people who have them, and it's interesting to see how fast you can make something run. There are smaller computers like the ARMs. The low-power ARM stands for something like the Advanced RISC Machine, or is it Acorn that's the company involved? I don't know. The Acorn was long ago. Is that actually part of the name, ARM? Or they're a different thing? Okay, Advanced RISC Machine. Whatever ARM stands for, it's the chip used in, say, the Zaris PDA and various other low-power devices, and that's an interesting machine to optimize code for. It's not something I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to focus on some big processors like people's laptops and desktops and servers, which all have at least 32-bit very fast processors. The ARM actually is 32-bit, but a low-power kind of slow processor, and it becomes even more interesting on those low-power processors to see how quickly you can do something just because the user doesn't want to wait forever for the machine to get something done. You could think about 8-bit washing machine processors that people sometimes put into smart cards. You could think about FPGAs, hardware implementations. But the smaller your processor gets, the fewer of the techniques that I mentioned are going to apply. For instance, when I talk about the very important use of floating point arithmetic for speeding up big integer multiplication and other big integer operations, that's something which is completely inapplicable to a chip that does not have floating point arithmetic, like some of these 8-bit, well, all of these 8-bit processors don't have floating point. Similarly, if you're writing Verilog or VHDL, designing a circuit for implementation directly into hardware, then you will make different choices of functions and certainly different choices of how you compute the functions from what you do on a Pentium. You'd want to have functions which work in characteristic 2. You'd want to have, even if you don't have a function that works in characteristic 2, you would not want to do the computations the same way that I'll be talking about. Some of the techniques I say, many, I'd say it's about a 50-50 split between the high-level techniques that do apply to every processor and the machine-specific techniques that do at least pay attention to processors, and then there's some fraction of the techniques which are very processor specific for making things run as quickly as possible. And if you choose a machine that is outside the norm for big computers like laptops and desktops, then of course you're limiting the techniques that you can apply, and you have to think of other techniques that apply to your chosen platform. But there are many other techniques that I'll talk about which do apply. If you want my advice on specifics of how fast something goes, my own experience is much more with the big processors than with the little processors, so I've been trying to learn hardware design, but it's not something where I'm an expert on it like lots of other people, and if you wanted to do some small processor, then, well, you'd get less feedback from me. But anyway, any processor is a legitimate target. I do assume that the set of platforms for cryptography is something that is hard to change. That for me, I will look at what Intel produces, and then that might change every year or so, but it's pretty much a constant at any moment. And it's not something that I get to change. If you're designing hardware, you get to change everything in how your chip works, and then that somewhat changes the game of optimizing cryptography, but a lot of the higher level principles still apply. Yeah?
Do you already have benchmarks for how to identify whether you actually do have a speed up?
Question of whether you do have a speed up. How do you measure speed generally? This is something I will talk about carefully. It's not going to be a huge amount of the course time, but it is an important topic which I'll get to later in the week. And it's certainly very important to be able to look at some software and figure out exactly how fast it is. You can use some very crude timing tools, but I'll talk about the best and still surprisingly easy to use timing tools.
My question actually was, you know, the speed stuff meant, but if you look and say, okay, this works basically,
oh, if you mean submitting to eBay. Everything that is available now is you can download all the data for the previous timing. So whatever submissions come in, the benchmarks are rerun every now and then, and so obviously there's some latency between new submissions and finding out how fast they are. But things like what I was showing you before about the OpenSSL performance, that's in here. All the data is under this results section. And under results, you can download this data, which is in some documented format for there's some version information and identifying what's being timed. And then there's information like, okay, for computing ciphertext, for encrypting data with a public key system where the data is 709 bytes as a random example, how many cycles does that take on a PowerPC? Answer 2 million for whatever this system is. And all that data is available in a database you can download for lots of different machines, various systems. So you can certainly compare your performance on those machines to what's available there now. For stream ciphers, there's a different database of the timings available now. You can always look at as long as there's some previous implementation of a function, you can look at that and time it yourself, figure out how fast it is, versus whatever software you write, you can time that and see if it's faster. You should be aware that one piece of software for a function is not necessarily the fastest. If you were, for example, writing the world's best AES software and looking at some existing AES software, then you should think, wait a minute, the particular AES software that I download from somebody, even if it's labeled as being high speed, is perhaps not the fastest thing out there. So there might be several implementations to compare against. A project like EBATS is trying to do this as systematically as possible, fit as much as possible into the same framework so that it becomes easy for people to compare different implementations and different functions to each other, but for the moment it's just a few functions, few examples that are available and that have been timed, and the more that gets submitted, well, the more information is available about those. Similarly, eStream, there's some data about various stream ciphers, dozens of stream ciphers from 100 cryptographers who submitted the stream ciphers. Those have all been fairly systematically timed, although a lot of the software doesn't work, can't be timed for whatever reason. There are certainly lots of gaps in benchmarks. I will be talking about how you take one of these pieces of software and carefully see exactly, measure exactly how much time it's taking, and that's not too hard to do yourself. But if you want to rely on these centralized benchmark tools, you can also see from those how long various things take. Yeah?
There's another project in that regarding low-power devices.
Low power, it certainly, as I was saying before about ARMs and then much smaller washing machine processors, smart card processors, these are perhaps the most important future area for cryptographic software, but it's something that I know less about than the big processors. If you want to optimize some cryptographic software for one of those processors, then yeah, that's certainly a good project, and I'll be able to give some semi-informed advice on how fast the software is and how fast it should be, but it's different from, say, the Pentium, where I know exactly what the Pentium is doing every fraction of a clock cycle, and I can glance at thousands of lines of assembly language and say, nah, you should move that up there, that'll make it much faster. It's different once you've spent a while playing with the processor, then you have a much better idea of how it works. To the extent that there's processor-dependent optimization, then if you choose a small processor, certainly that's entirely justified as a processor to look at, and then all the high-level techniques I talk about should apply to that context as well. But the specific details of that processor, well, if you choose some processor or some big processor that I know about, then I'll be able to help more than with a small processor that I'm not so familiar with. Okay, more questions about the course project. Maybe I should also say, if people want to work together, I think it would be good instead of sort of each person who's interested picks some function and goes off in a corner and works on that. It's probably best if each person who's interested says, hey, here's like three or four functions that I'm interested in, and looks around for other people who are interested in doing these projects. Maybe let me just see a show of hands so I know how many and so people can identify each other, see if it's more than like one person. How many people are actually thinking of writing some software for this? So, okay, so there's some people. And let me see how many of you are interested in the secret key side of things, like stream ciphers and maybe hash functions, and okay, so there's, let me see, bigger show of hands, so, okay, so there's definitely a large fraction of the people who were expressing interest. How about, how many people are interested in public key? Okay, that seems like actually almost a superset, not exactly a superset, but all right, it seems like there's pretty broad interest among the several people who are interested in doing the project in different kinds of functions, so maybe people could start looking at the functions out there or come up to me afterwards and we'll chat a bit about what functions are available, what people have heard about and might be interested in, and then we can try to coordinate efforts instead of having people work separately. It'd be good to have people share ideas about the functions. Okay, I'm thinking it's about time for a break and for me to get some water, so let's have a 5-minute pause until that clock says 4:21. And then I'll continue on Poly 1305. Time to jump into actual course material. Yay. Water. Anybody want to hear the glug, glug, glug sound through the microphone? Alrighty, time for me to jump into Poly 1305. So as a reminder, the first quarter of the course, major topic number one. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to protect a whole bunch of messages using a long shared secret. So you can assume, as a prerequisite for everything we're going to do, that the sender and receiver have a long secret that nobody else knows, but the sender and receiver both know it. Using a long shared secret, somehow this should be used to protect a long series of messages. When I say protect, at first I'm just going to talk about forgery, then I'm going to get into eavesdropping, I'm going to ignore the issues of traffic analysis and denial of service, but we are going to make sure that the messages are encrypted so that people cannot understand them, aside from the timing and length, and we are going to make sure that the messages are not subject to forgery, even though they can be thrown away by the attacker if he's in charge of the network. So, using a long shared secret to protect a long series of messages. And let me emphasize, this is protecting them against forgery and eavesdropping. All right, let me start with the simplest case of protecting a single message. I'm going to start with a model of an internet protocol. This is really a definition of various words that I use, like sender and receiver. Here is a simplified internet protocol. There are actually four parties in this protocol. The split between the first two might seem a little bit artificial, but they will have different roles in a few minutes. There is, first of all, a message generator that produces one message, M, and sends it along to a sender, which for the moment simply passes M along, which is what might seem kind of silly about having a distinction between message generator and sender. The sender passes the message to a network, which is where the attacker resides, and then the network might change the message. The network might take M and change it into some M prime. There's no guarantee that the network sends the same message. M prime is delivered to a receiver who looks at M prime. This is a piece of an internet protocol. This is, for example, your communication to Google. You send information, a request, say, to Google, or you send email to somebody, ignoring the question of responses, confirmations from the server saying, yes, I got the message, you can stop resending it, etc. This is the most basic picture you might draw of an internet protocol, aside from what, again, might seem frivolous, distinguishing between the message generator and the sender. The role of the network in the middle is, again, to carry our attacker. Let me emphasize what these parties actually do, what the protocol consists of. The message generator at the top produces just one message and then it quits. The message generator creates one message, M, and then once I'm done analyzing one message, which already interestingly triggers essentially all of the security issues and most of the speed issues that we care about, the message generator creates one message. After I've done with that, I'll do multiple messages, but for the moment, message generator creates M. The sender gives M to the network. Which somehow delivers a message to the receiver, not necessarily the same one. The network gives a message M prime to the receiver. And here's where something can go wrong from a security perspective. If the network is controlled by an attacker, M prime is not necessarily the same as M. Maybe the network is controlled by an attacker. Maybe that results in M prime being different from M, which is a forgery. The reason this can happen, again, is that what you should be imagining in the real world is that maybe this network, the machines between the sender and receiver, the radio physical network between the sender and receiver, whatever the internet consists of delivering M from the sender to the receiver, is actually owned or controlled by an attacker. Suddenly I realized I could have moved the board up. Oops, I'll do that in a minute. If the attacker is not present or not interested in this particular message, then M prime is equal to M. Of course, the attacker could also throw M away. That's not something reflected in the protocol as shown here. The way to fit that into this protocol would be M prime is just completely independent of M. The attacker delivers whatever he wants, and then the receiver does not receive the original message. Lots of things are going wrong here. Let me focus on the forgery, the fact that M prime is potentially different from M, and the receiver has no way to tell. In order to stop forgery, we'll throw in Poly 1305, whose entire role is to attach something to the message that the receiver can check in order to reliably, guaranteed, provably, detect forgeries. Question? At this point, well, Poly 1305 will just, so I've simplified here in a couple of ways, Poly 1305 is just addressing forgery. Eavesdropping actually is very easy. That's what the one-time pad does. I'll be adding that later. A little trickier is handling multiple messages. So I've simplified this first by throwing away eavesdropping and by throwing away the long series of messages, making it just a single message. And I'm going to simplify further, but let me draw the Poly 1305 picture of what it does, which, yes, from this picture you'll see it does not protect against eavesdropping. So this is Poly 1305 forgery protection. Changes the protocol as follows. The message generator is still producing one message, M, but the sender is then going to attach something to the message. Message generator produces M. The sender is going to have a secret shared with the receiver. The sender uses some secrets called R and S. In order to compute some authenticator, a tag, an authentication tag A, which is appended to the message, that is provided to the network, which has no protocol obligations, no real-world obligations to deliver the same message. The attacker maybe produces M prime and A prime. And then the receiver has the same secrets, R and F, and is going to use those to double-check the A prime and see whether it matches M prime, which hopefully is going to guarantee that M prime equals M. The receiver has the same secrets, R and F, shared with the sender. As you can see from the picture, M being provided to the network, this answers your question that, yes, there's no protection here against eavesdropping. There is just protection against forgery. Lots of details that I have to specify here. Let me repeat the critical features of this picture about what the pieces are called. This A, in particular, is something that the sender attaches, the sender computes an authenticator, this A, from R, S, and M. And then the sender gives M and A, and not R and S, to the network. Sender sends M with this authenticator attached to it. The network, as before, can change M prime and A prime. So maybe the pair M prime A prime is different from M and A. If the network does not have an attacker in it, well, it could still have random errors that change the M prime and A prime. Those are easier to deal with, but presumably a working network, M prime and A prime will equal M and A. If we protect against malicious forgery, certainly we're protecting against accidents as well. Certainly, if there is an attacker and he changes the message, the damage he can do here is change MA into a different M prime A prime. Really, changing the A is not damage, but he could change M into a different M prime, and that's definitely damage, which we're going to stop. The receiver checks, the receiver recomputes A prime, and let me put a question mark here, using the same computation starting from M prime, oops, R and S, which the receiver knows, and M prime instead of M. If A prime does not match, if the same function applied to RS M prime does not match A prime, then the receiver throws away M prime and A prime. The receiver discards M prime and A prime if the result of the computation doesn't match. And that discarding is going to get rid of forgeries. All right, what is this function? That's the heart of the system, is what is going on with the R, S, and how do those produce an authenticator A? What is R? What is S? And then, most importantly, what is this function that, given R, S, and M, produces A? R, S, M, map to A. Well, I'm going to give a slightly oversimplified answer. This answer will be secure, but for speed reasons, it is not what people actually do. And then I will correct the answer tomorrow and give you exactly what Pauli 1305 does for one message, and then I'll deal with the other simplifications, the long series of messages versus one message, and forgery versus forgery, and eavesdropping. Question?
You're not concerned about
for the moment, we're not concerned about denial of service. Some of what happens here will be pieces you need to protect against denial of service. The best you can hope for protecting against denial of service is that you maintain your connections to the extent that you still have a network left. The attacker, if he's in complete control of the network, can always flood it. Denial of service is always possible, but it's a quantitative question of how much work the attacker has to do, how close the attacker has to be, how much data he has to flood you with in order to deny your service. There are denial of service aspects to what I say, and one of the reasons that I mentioned before I recommend against using the message authentication code built into Felix, one of the reasons for that is thinking ahead to denial of service protection. But for the moment, let me just analyze this protocol from the perspective of the forgery protection. Maybe a simple example of how there's a connection between high-speed cryptography and stopping denial of service. Suppose the attacker feeds you a bunch of messages, a bunch of forged messages, forcing you, the receiver, to keep computing the same function of all of those fake messages. And then occasionally, a legitimate message gets through the same radio connection you hear a legitimate message, which the attacker did not manage to intercept. The attacker could still be flooding your CPU with so much work computing this function on all the fake messages that you don't have time to hear the legitimate message and to perform the same computation. Speeding up this computation actually improves the same protocol from a denial of service perspective. But for today, the security model is just going to be, okay, the attacker changes a message, do we detect that change? And that's the distinction between forgery and denial of service, is that forgery would be an undetected change to M. Here we're going to detect any change to M and A, and in particular we're going to detect any change to M. Alrighty, so here's the oversimplified, but not drastically so, version of Pauli 1305. And this is enough to do the security analysis, see some of the speed aspects, and then I'll show you what's tweaked in the real thing tomorrow. First of all, R and F are random numbers modulo P. What is P? Well, I'll tell you. R and F, these are independent, uniform, random elements of Z mod P. What is P? It is 2 to the 130 minus 5. Why is this function called poly 1305? Well, there's the answer, 2 to the 130 minus 5. It's a mnemonic device. Why is this prime 2 to the 130 minus 5 chosen? Well, otherwise, that wouldn't fit with poly 1305. No. There's a real reason for 2 to the 130 minus 5 to be the best prime that anybody's been able to find for this application, and I'll go through the speed motivation for choosing this prime. There's also a size issue for the prime, and putting those together seems to focus attention on this particular prime as being the best one that we have. All right, what else do I have to define? The messages M. A message is, by definition, a polynomial in one variable over Z mod P. M is in the polynomial ring Z mod P adjoint X, with an extra restriction that M of 0 equals 0. And then the function mapping R, S, and M to A is simply A equals M applied to R plus S. You take this polynomial M, plug in R. M is your message. You regard it as a polynomial, evaluate that at R, and then add S to it. Have I introduced everything I need for the definition? I think the answer is yes. Maybe I should give some lower level definitions here just in case. The Z mod P there, the mathematician, I love writing the word definition. So definitions, Z mod P is the ring 0, 1, 2, etc. through P minus 1, where the ring operations, plus and minus, unary, say, and times, and let's not forget 0 and 1. Universal algebraists would complain if I didn't include 0 and 1 there. Those ring operations are defined modulo P. For instance, if you add F and G, where F and G are specified as elements of Z mod P, then their sum is the usual integer addition mod P. For instance, P minus 1 plus 3 equals 2. Saying this is a ring means, of course, that this set with those operations satisfies every identity. Saying it's a commutative ring means it satisfies every identity satisfied by the integers with their operations. The polynomial ring, Z mod P adjoint X, so this is, of course, the set of polynomials in one variable X with coefficients in Z mod P. This formally is the set of vectors, M0, M1, M2, etc. Infinite vectors which have the following properties. Each of the m's is an integer between 0 and p minus 1. Each m sub i is in Z mod P, and only finitely many of them are non-zero. If you look at the set of i's such that m sub i is non-zero, this is the set of i such that m sub i is not equal to 0. The number of those i's is finite, less than infinity. The ring operations on the polynomial ring well, I'm not going to do just the ring operations, but I'm also going to add the x unary operation, operations plus, minus, times, constants 0, 1, and x, are defined in such a way that these sequences M0, M1, M2 represent, well, are equal to M0 plus M1x plus M2x squared, etc. Defined so that the sequence M0, M1, M2, ... is equal to M0 plus M1x plus M2x squared plus etc. Some people might say that defining polynomials is getting into a bit of nitpicking here, but actually from a practical implementation perspective, if you want to represent polynomials inside a computer, you should use exactly this definition and not start doing some powers of x, whatever exactly that means. Well, okay, you can interpret powers of x as vectors. If you want to write down a polynomial inside the computer, write it as a vector. I think there's more words I have to define here. Let's work on random. I often bump into people who think the word random means, well, just it's an element. It's something random, but that's not right. A random element is something higher level. It is an element of Z mod p for each possible universe. At least intuitively, this is an element of Z mod p for each conceivable universe that we're in. And this, of course, is an infinite vector of possible elements. You write down the list of universes, and then for each one, say which element of Z mod p it is. In other words, this is a function, and now to be careful with my definitions, this is a measurable function. From the set of possible universes, which is conventionally denoted PR for probability space, to the set where your elements lie, namely Z mod p. PR is some probability space. Which intuitively is the set of possible universes. Probability space, if you want the definition. If you care about theorems relying on the concept of randomness, then, well, look up probability space in your real analysis textbook. If you have a coin flip, that is a random element of the set heads, comma, tails, or 0, comma, 1. It is something that in some universes is 0 and in other universes is 1. Measurability is also defined as in real analysis, but okay, a coin flip is measurable. You can look at it and there you've measured it. The set of possible universes where the coin comes up heads is a measurable set, and same for tails, and similar definitions for any function like this. So that is what a random element means, is that for each possible universe, there's some choice of R and S. A few more definitions, and oops, there I go again, erasing something unnecessarily. I still have that board. Let me switch to that board. For those of you who know all the definitions, I assume you're thinking about why such a ridiculously simple function provides security against attacks, and then if you've gotten through that, why 2 to the 130 minus 5? Let me pause for a question.
The computation of A is apparently the ring
as opposed to the integer addition. Yeah, so M has coefficients in Z mod P, R is in Z mod P, S is in Z mod P, and I. If I meant to switch out of Z mod P, then I would say so explicitly. So these are evaluate M at R, add S modulo P. Final result is between 0 and P minus 1. Yeah. Okay, so a few more words I need to define here. Uniform, that's an important one. Uniform means that every possibility is equally likely. for instance, a uniform random coin flip is one where half your universe is it comes up heads and half it comes up tails. The probability of heads is one half, probability of tails is one half. A uniform element of Z mod P, S is a uniform element of the set 0 through P minus 1. There are P possibilities for it, each of which has probability 1 over P. So you choose completely randomly, no bias towards any particular number or against any particular number. You have exactly a 1 over P chance of producing each of those numbers between 0 and 2 to the 130 minus 6 for S, and similarly for R. And then those are independent, which means that probabilities of pairs multiply. Let me just say the independent uniform whole phrase here, independent uniform random elements R, S of Z mod P. What that means is that each possibility for the pair R, S has chance 1 over P squared. Any possibility for R has chance 1 over P. Any possibility for S has chance 1 over P. In other words, the pair R, S is uniform. R, S is a uniform random element of the product space Z mod P times Z mod P. Uniform random element of Z mod P times Z mod P. In other words, each possibility for the pair has chance 1 over P squared. The probability that R, S is equal to any particular pair F, G, for instance 5, 7, this probability is 1 over P squared for each pair of numbers F and G in Z mod P times Z mod P. Of these various words, I would say if you have some idea of what it means to do something randomly, you don't have to have the real analysis unless you want to prove theorems. If you understand independence and uniformity, uniform means every possibility is equally likely. Independent means that there's no interaction. Well, there could be some sort of interaction, but the probabilities say that there's no interaction. The probability of any pair is the product of the probabilities of each individual possibility for R and for S. And in particular, independent uniform, when you see that, you should say each possibility for the pair is equally likely. There are P squared possibilities for R and S. Each of them has a tiny probability, 1 over P squared of appearing, 1 over 2 to the 260 of appearing. Well, about 1 over 2 to the 260. Question? R and S will only be used by the sender once. You could engage in the same protocol where the receiver allows many messages to be sent, and when I get into the many message situation, that'll be an important feature. But for the moment, the receiver gets one message from the network and then either discards it or does not. Of course, if the receiver allows many tries, then the chance of a forgery succeeding gets multiplied by the number of tries. But for the moment, R and S are used once by the sender and then once by the receiver. Alrighty. Is there anything else to say definition-wise? I think not, and I still have some time for examples. Good. All right, let's take a typical message. How about let's take the message M equals 0, 0, 1, and then all zeros after that. I should express this in the usual X notation. This is simply 0 plus 0x plus 1x squared plus etc. In other words, x squared. And let's say that R is equal to about 2 to the 65 with malice aforethought. And I realize that I did forget to stick in a definition here, namely the definition of evaluation, which, okay, this example will be in a moment after the definition of evaluation. Of course, M of R is defined by, you simply plug in R into the polynomial there. M of R means M0 plus M1R plus M2R squared. plus, etc., which terminates at some point finite sum of elements of Z mod T, giving you a number between 0 and T minus 1. For instance, the requirement that I had that M of 0 equals 0 is tantamount to saying that the first coefficient, M sub 0, equals 0. As all my examples will comply with. If M is, in particular, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, etc., then let's evaluate M at R. M of R is equal to, let's just plug in R into x squared, and we get R squared, which is 2 to the 65 squared, 2 to the 130, that's equal to 5. Good. If you then added, say, S is 2 to the 130 minus 2, and M and R are defined as above, then M of R plus S, and oops, 2 to the 130 minus 2 is not allowed. That's too big. How about 2 to the 130 minus 7? Then M of R plus S is 5 plus 2 to the 130 minus 7, which sounds to me like 3, because all the arithmetic is done mod 2 to the 130 minus 5. All right, let's try a bigger example, and this is one with the complete protocol, and I'm going to claim that this is actually secure. The computations are just beyond what I wanted to do in my head, so I'm going to copy the numbers here. I did choose the numbers so I could fit them onto the blackboard, but let's say the sender and receiver have the following shared secrets. They would have had to be really unlucky to choose these particular shared secrets. You should not assume anybody using the protocol actually has these secrets, but there is a chance of 1 over 2 to the 260, roughly, that they happen to choose R equals 1048576 and S equals 8675309. And let's assume that the message generator produces the following message. Not allowed to have a constant term here. M is 3x plus x to the 7th. What does the sender do with this protocol? The sender computes M, A, where A is M of R plus S, as shown on the left there. What is M of R plus S? Well, let's do that computation. The sender computes M of R plus S, which means plug in R into this M. 3 times R is 3 times 1048576. Plus 1048576 to the 7th, plus S is 8675309. And now here, let me emphasize these integers are modulo p. The 1048576 to the 7th, I chose this example so the result wouldn't be too big. That's 2 to the 20th to the 7th, 2 to the 140, which is 5 times 2 to the 10th. And if you calculate 5 times 10, 24, 5, 1, 2, 0, and add it to 3 times 1048576 and add that, then, okay, didn't want to actually pause to do it. 1182615 7. And now the sender sends the message M, which is 3x plus x to the 7th, presumably transmitted as 3, 0, 0, etc., with a 1 for the x to the 7th, and then some sort of termination signal, comma, what was the number again? Oh, yeah, right here, 1182615 7. What does the network then do, and what does the receiver do? Well, I'll stick that in a partially erased board here, and then I think that's enough for today. The receiver accepts some M prime A prime, which is not necessarily the same as this M comma A. The network maybe changes M and A. The receiver accepts M prime and A prime if, well, okay, at this point I don't think I need my notes. If what is the condition for A? A prime is M prime of the same R that I wrote there, 1048576, plus 8675309. All, of course, modulo P. Now, I claim that this is secure. First of all, it works in the sense that if M prime and A prime are equal to M and A, then the receiver does accept. If M prime and A prime equals MA, if the message and the authenticator have not been changed, then the receiver does accept, because the receiver is doing the same computation the sender did and coming up with the same result, which matches. The receiver accepts. And this is an important property. You could, of course, set up a cryptographic protocol where all messages are rejected and then guarantee that forgeries will be rejected, which is part of what we want. We do want to guarantee forgeries are rejected, but we also want to get legitimate messages through. This gets legitimate messages through. And I claim that it does not get forgeries through. Forgeries will be rejected. Not necessarily, but I claim that every attack strategy, every attacker has negligible chance of finding a pair M prime and A prime, which I should say is not equal to M and A, such that A prime satisfies the equation. A prime equals M prime of R plus S. Well, I'll be concrete about that next time. The answer in short will be the maximum message degree divided by P, divided by 2 to the 130 minus 5. So if your messages are, say, a kilobyte for an internet packet, or a gigabyte maybe is a reasonable limit on an email message size, then a gigabyte might, depending how you encode it as a polynomial, fit into, say, 2 to the 27 or so degree, and then 2 to the 27 divided by 2 to the 130 minus 5 is 2 to the minus 103. But I'll go through exactly what negligible means next time, actually prove this, and, well, say carefully what the formalization of this is after I've done the intuitive proof. I'm not going to go through the formal proof, but for those of you who care about doing the proofs and what kind of mathematics shows up in that, I do want to at least once give the definitions of this type of security theorem, what's actually going on here. In any case, I want to intuitively explain this. That's important. Talk about some attacks on this protocol. Then fix the simplifications, like the fact that real-world messages are strings of bytes. How do we encode those as strings of coefficients modulo p, which is still a little different from polynomials modulo p. What else were the tweaks here? There are some restrictions on R and S, a slight change in the definition of A for the real-world Pauli 1305 protocol. I want to go through those, which I will say are for speed reasons, but first I want to give the definition and do the slightly revised security analysis. Then I'll generalize long messages, fix the lack of eavesdropping protection, and finally, I would say by tomorrow afternoon, get into speed, which will require me to define what speed is, what the cost model is for measuring time of a computation. But all that stuff is tomorrow. Were there any questions about the definition of this protocol, what computation is going on, what the security claim means? Well, okay, this I'll do in more detail tomorrow, and again get back to what negligible means, but at least it should be clear at this point what the protocol says to compute. Yeah? Yes, the security will depend, you can quantify this, the security will depend on how well RNS are distributed. You do need RNS to be, the question was, does the real protocol care about this uniformity, that every possibility for RNS is equally likely? And the answer is yes. If RNS are slightly non-uniform, you can still prove something about security. But if RNS had only, say, half their possible values, then that would reduce security by conceivably a factor of 2. If you use some very non-uniform way to generate RNS, you could lose all security here. Extreme example would be if you always chose R equals 1048576 and S equals 8675309, then the attacker, assuming he guesses what you've done, which if you've just chosen that single RNS, then presumably the attacker knows what you've done to generate RNS, even if he doesn't see your random choices. If somebody has a protocol specification that says choose R equals this and S equals that, then the attacker looks at that specification and says, whoops, I can forge any message I want because I know the RNS. You need RNS to be reasonably random for this to have a security proof, which I'll go through next time. All right, other questions about the protocol?